Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Jane Clayson, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Tweens at the day spa. These girls aren't yet teenagers, but do not underestimate their spending power or their passion for fashion. 10-year-olds, 8-year-olds, even 6-year-olds are dishing billions out of their play purses for everything from glitter makeup and pedicures to beauty magazines. Marketers are throwing slumber parties, eager to know what a little girl wants. This hour, On Point, girls as beauty consumers and what it means for girlhood. Joining me first from New York City is Camille Sweeney. She is a contributor to the New York Times. She wrote the February 28th article, Never Too Young for That First Pedicure, for the Times column Skin Deep. Camille, thanks for joining us.
Hi, Jane. How are you?
Good. Fine. Your story caught our eye. I wonder if you'd tell us what you discovered first in your reporting of marketing to these young girls.
Well, my quest sort of began first in looking at their beauty habits. And as I kept digging deeper, I realized that there is a whole phenomenon of social beauty that's going on with these girls. And that would be starting at really as young as 4, girls who are being brought to nail spas with their mothers usually and sort of observing manicures, pedicures, and the mother thinking that it might be cute if they try it, and then the girl tries it, and the salons offer discount prices for these little girls to get these different services that would have formerly been considered for at least teenage or young adults to be starting.
So define that market, because when you say 4-year-olds, that doesn't typically fall into that tween market that you think of, the age before the teenage years.
That's right. Well, it did. I think about half a decade ago, it started with the tween girls, and that would be, anywhere from 8 to 12. And now it's moved down. What I noticed was it's actually moved pretty solidly into this 5, 6, 7, and 8-year-old. Mm. So it's sort of a pre-tween age. Mm-hmm.
You mentioned social beauty, and you write about in your piece these primping parties. You talked a little bit about it for these 5- and 6-year-olds, pedicures and manicures and even mini makeovers, I think you write in your piece. Generally prompted by parents or by the youngsters themselves?
Most of the parents that I spoke with had already sent their daughters to a primping party. So I do think it began sort of amongst the girls themselves. And, it's something that they're growing up with, seeing a lot of reality TV where there's a lot of this primping going on in social groups. And so the mothers that I spoke with, for the most part, it was the daughters who suggested, except for one girl who was 7, and it was actually her father who suggested the salon party for her birthday.
So they get the idea from a television show, whatever it may be, America's Top Model or Hannah Montana or you name it, and they see the girls on TV doing this, and so they get the idea that they should do it themselves.
That's it. That's right. And another thing that I discovered was it's a growing business for nail salons who are sort of always looking for new niche markets. So they're really starting to put their efforts into figuring out what these little girls may want at a party.
You cited a study in your New York Times piece. You talked about the number of 6- to 9-year-olds who are using lip gloss, lipstick, nail polish, and the like. Tell us the numbers.
Well, last year, the study was 55% of the 6- to 9-year-old girls using lip gloss or lipstick, as compared with 2004, which was 49%. So it's significant, and you're starting to see that trend upwards for this younger cohort. So the marketers are definitely saying it's a significant bump for them.
So where is the money coming from for these girls to be spending? Is it allowance money? Is this indulgent parents? I mean, where are they getting the dough?
It's interesting. One thing that I didn't write about in the piece was allowance, but I did look into it. And for this 6 to 9 year old girls, they're about 30% of them are getting an allowance, which is not a high number. But of that group, the average is about $7.50 a week, which could add up to a lot of lip gloss. You know, these price points are relatively small, $1.99, $2.50, something like that. So the girls themselves save up to buy it, and then they get these sort of bonanza kits around their birthdays or different holidays where you could get 40 or even, you know, 60 pieces of makeup for $35 that, you know, a grandmother might buy or an aunt.
That would last a while.
That would last a while.
Let me bring another voice into our conversation, Camille. Joining me from New York City is Samantha Ski. She is Senior Vice President for Strategic Marketing at Alloy Media and Marketing. Samantha, nice to have you. Welcome.
Hi, Jane.
So you're here to talk about the business, not the morality of marketing to kids. So with that as a backdrop, from a marketing perspective, what ages are you targeting?
Well, we specifically aren't targeting anyone, but the advertisers and marketers who we work with are looking at anywhere from about 6 years of age up through teenagers.
And from an economics perspective, how much money are these kids spending?
The kids themselves, tweens, if we identify tweens as 8 to 12-year-olds, they're spending an average right now of about $51 billion annually. And then what's sort of most interesting, I think, to marketers is the additional $150 billion of their parents' money that they're influencing. So there's their own spend, and then there's the incremental influence over parental spending that's occurring and that's really increased among this smaller subsegment of the youth population.
And how are our companies meeting the demand?
You know, there's certainly the supply and demand is very it's hard to tease out whether the interest, you know, is coming from the kids or the demand is being created based on a new product innovation. But there are lots and lots of products now, from cell phones to automotive features to all kinds of different entertainment platforms that are being developed specifically with tweens or, you know, this sort of younger teen in mind. Then the question becomes, how do they market those? How are corporations marketing those products to young people? How are they getting around the parent or incorporating the parent in order to reach that tween consumer? And that's where, you know, where we're often consulted, mm-hmm. and that's kind of a tricky question.
You mentioned the cell phones and the entertainment items. Among the 6, 8, 10, 12-year-olds, what part of that sector is growing? Is it that, the cell phones and the entertainment? Is it clothes? What is the driving force among this
sector? Sure, that's
sector?
A good question. Well, first, to back up a bit, there are the number of 8 to 12-year-olds in the U.S. has increased 5% approximately just since, you know, 1994, if you looked at 8 to 12-year-olds in the country, just, you know, 10, 15 years ago. So the population size has increased. The number of tweens who have their own money and the amount of influence likewise have increased. So there's a bigger amount of consumer influence emanating from this group. So it's beginning with that, then, you know, we've got product development across all different, really just from food, which is it's important to note, is the A number one spending category for this subsegment. So although the more interesting are probably electronics, cellular technology, beauty, because they have, you know, it's sort of feels newer, they're spending most of their money on food and often on not very healthy food, if we want to open another bag of issues. that's one right there. So the growth, though, that we see is primarily in entertainment, social beauty and the notion of sort of collaborative purchasing of beauty products is certainly an interesting area, because it's so easy to track the increase in products and then to look at where they're being marketed and consumed. And that's, you know, that is a growing space as well. Cell phones, usage of cell phones among tweens has been increasing consistently for the past 10 years. Likewise, handheld devices that are not necessarily cell phones. So there's, you know, clothing likewise continues to increase, but that has always been a second or third area of spending for tweens. So that's not as exciting.
So I only have about a minute left, Samantha, but I'd like to ask you, you're in the middle of this. I asked Camille the same question, and I'm wondering from your marketing expertise, how does the media affect all of this?
The media is really interesting, and unfortunately it's a much longer answer than a minute, but young people, tweens, are very aspirational. So they're watching television. They're engaged with web properties and web content that is not, you would not imagine, is targeted to their age group. So there's that's sort of a big rift when you look at MTV, Nickelodeon, any number of media options for young people that are really building their programming. They would say specifically for a teenager, but the tweens are watching it, and the advertising that's integrated there is for teens, not for tweens. So that's an opportunity for advertisers to get at tweens without offending, without really aggressively offending, I suppose, some of the organizations who are trying to protect the younger kids from that type of advertising.
Samantha Ski, Senior Vice President at the Alloy Media and Marketing Group. Thanks so much for your time, Samantha.
Sure. Thanks, Jane.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking this hour about marketing to preteens or tweens, particularly 8 to 12-year-olds now as young as 6. Camille Sweeney is with us. She is a contributor to the New York Times and wrote the recent article, Never Too Young for That First Pedicure. I wonder if you'd start us out in this segment, Camille, by sharing an anecdote or two, if you would. And I'm wondering, in your reporting for the Times piece, if anything surprised you, because when I heard about marketers sponsoring birthday parties and sleepovers in this age group, I thought, oh, my goodness, what's next? Did anything surprise you?
I actually was surprised by the it was two things. The level of sophistication of these girls. I went to 3 different primping parties, and 2 girls were turning 6 and 1 girl was turning 7. And they knew what they wanted. They had just this sort of very fluid sense of themselves in terms of the products and the different services that they were requesting. And on one level, they were play acting, and there was that sense of play. But one of the parties, it's a little bit of a Sex and the City theme, and to have the 6-year-olds with little tiny Cosmo martini glasses and having their nails and, toenails and fingernails done, you just wondered, what is the expectation going to be for these girls? Grooming is one thing, but this level of sort of vanity grooming is definitely something that would concern me as the mother of a daughter, a young girl.
Well, tell us about the marketing campaigns specifically aimed at these girls. We just heard from our marketer in our last segment, but what is the message that these young girls, the 6-year-olds, 8-year-olds, what is the message that they're taking? What are they feeling? What are they hearing from the marketing that's directed at them?
When I was speaking with a lot of the different cosmetic manufacturers, and that would be the Disney licensed products, Hannah Montana and High School Musical, as well as Bratz, there was American Girl Cosmetics. I mean, there's no end of cosmetics. And the manufacturers themselves are sort of promoting this sense of self-empowerment and self-expression. I do believe what the girls are taking away, however, is something a little more sinister than that, and that is that this product can help them be more popular, or, you know, get through life a little easier. If they're just a little bit more like Hannah Montana, then boys might like them. And that's what concerned me, I would say, about the marketing specifically to them, because it's almost like candy. It is very appetizing to these young girls to see these little pinks, and everything's repackaged in these very vibrant colors. And there is a feeling of, if that's going to be, you know, swinging from your backpack or in your pocket, that you are now accepted into a new level of social standing that you might not have if you didn't have this lip gloss or, you know, little glitter eye makeup.
Let me bring in another voice here from Princeton, New Jersey, Jeannie Brooks-Gunn. She's a professor of child development at Columbia University and co-director of the National Center for Children and Families. She's just finished editing a volume of the journal The Future of Children on the topic of children and electronic media. Jeannie, welcome back to On Point.
Hello, Jane. How are you?
Fine, thank you. Thanks for being here. I wonder if your perspective, from a child development perspective, you could explain to us what marketing impact the 6 to 9-year-old set takes away from all this. What is the impact of the marketing to these kids?
Yes, I'd love to talk about that. Basically, when we're talking about children that age, they see marketing very differently than a 10 or an 11 or a 12-year-old. And I think that's important for parents to realize. So young kids do not understand that advertising and marketing is meant to persuade them. They perceive this kind of marketing as a helpful source of information about goods. And I think what Camille said, really, from what she observed in the parties, is a perfect example of that. The kids think that they're being given information that will be helpful to them, rather than seeing that this is a marketing ploy. As kids get older, they start understanding marketing somewhat better. But at this age, they don't. The examples, actually, the primping party is a perfect example of what has been called viral marketing, getting a buzz going about a product. Mm-hmm. And these parties are a perfect example.
Because little girls like to talk, don't they?
Oh, yeah. And viral marketing is used for everything. You're also seeing examples in this new push for beauty products for young girls, all the other types of marketing that are used for children, the examples given earlier about toys and food. You could see this as a toy, except it has further ramifications than most toys do. So you see people starting to do product placement, people starting to do what we call stealth marketing, which is even hard for older kids to understand, and that would be the celebrity buy-ins, as I said, mm-hmm. product placements mm-hmm. that kids may have. The online interactive agents, which is something that we're becoming increasingly concerned about in games and what we call advertainment, where you see selling of goods vis-a-vis online games. Hmm. And it really blurs the distinction between advertising and entertainment.
So I guess I'm curious, Jeannie, how all this affects the maturation process. Are young girls in this country maturing earlier now because of this in some way?
Well, they're not maturing earlier because of this. What I like to think about, or have parents think about, is the fact that we want to think about physical maturing, emotional maturing, and social maturation, as well as cognitive maturation. What you're seeing here is quicker, or at least a belief that you can accelerate the social maturation, i.e. looking more like a tween or a teenager. The fact of the matter is, a 6-year-old is still a 6-year-old. You're not really developing their capacities to be more socially or emotionally mature. So what worries me and worries other people like me is the fact that as you move younger children into more sophisticated venues, they really aren't ready for those venues. Mm. I mean, it sounds like something the grandmother might say, but it's actually very true.
I want to get to the phones because we have a lot of callers wanting to join here. Anne is first up from Natick, Massachusetts. Anne, welcome to you. Hi.
Hi, Jane. Thanks for covering this topic. I'm thrilled that you're doing this today.
Well, thanks
for
your call.
I'm the mother of a 3.5-year-old who's in preschool.
Ah.
Tomorrow is pajama day,
mm-hmm.
which will be sort of a fake sleepover party. And on the flyer that came home, one of the activities listed was nail painting,
mm-hmm.
which I couldn't believe. Seemingly innocuous, but as you're saying today, not at all. And about the time that she turned 3, my little girl started saying that she needed makeup to make her pretty and all of these things, which I am just slaving to fight against at home. But then to, you know, put her in a preschool environment and have some of those messages eking in, I made my career in marketing. I can see it a mile away, and it's just, I'm not saying they have a motive, but it's, we all need to be on guard against this stuff, and it bothers me a lot.
Anne, thank you so much for your perspective. Jeannie, I guess I wonder, you know, well, okay, so they're painting their nails. Isn't that okay?
Well, there are different ways to look at it. If you're painting your nails and going and having primping parties, suggesting that the way you look really matters for who you are as a person, and we're starting to teach children that at 3, 4, 5, 6, or 7, then I do think it's an issue. Think about the issues we have with eating disorders and with body image problems. These types of problems start in girls often at ages 8 and 9. If we're starting the process of looking at beauty earlier and earlier, it's very likely that we'll start seeing body image issues earlier and earlier. We may see girls at least saying they're on diets earlier and earlier. This is not healthy for kids.
Christy is on the line now from Newport News, Virginia. Christy, welcome to you. Hi.
Hi, Jane.
Hi.
I just wanted to say I have a 4-year-old, and she and I kind of use primping and things like that together, almost like a bonding type of thing. She has a very strong sense of self, and she knows she's beautiful, and, you know, she doesn't have any issues with that sort of thing. And I don't think that it seems to be a problem as long as it's used in moderation. Just, you know, I was telling the other lady we have a family fun night, and sometimes after her little brother will go to bed, we'll sit and soak our feet on Friday nights and eat popcorn and do our nails and things like that. And it's really a fun thing to do together, like I said, as long as it's just in moderation. And I make sure that she knows that she's smart as well as beautiful and everything that goes along with that.
Christy, thanks so much for your perspective. Camille or Jeannie, do you want to weigh in on this? Christy says it's used in moderation. It's a together time, fun activity, something they do. She's teaching her daughter other things as well. Is that okay?
Well, I love the idea that she's put it into a mother-daughter activity that they're doing together. I see that as very different than going out to the malls and buying beauty kits. I see this as very different than having primping parties with all the girls comparing what they're doing.
So, Jeannie, is it all come down to the parents then? Is it the mother who sets the tone for and the father for how a girl views all this?
Well, we like to think that we really set the tone, and certainly parents have a lot of control over what happens. The worry is, and this is the marketing issue, is that given more and more marketing of beauty products, what that means is the parents actually have less control over how this is perceived and how it's used in the bigger culture.
Camille, from your reporting,
agree.
Yeah, join in, please.
Well, it's interesting because I feel like a lot of the cosmetic manufacturers that I spoke with have this sort of buzzword they use, which is mother approved. And it is something that within the context of a mother-daughter bond or an aunt and a niece, it can be a special time, and it can be instructive to teach about grooming and taking care of yourself and having self-esteem on that body level, that physical level. I think where it starts to become more divisive is as the children get older. Your first caller mentioning that at 3.5 they're doing their nails. That to me seems as if you're setting up to, if not everyone is interested in having their nails done, then you are starting to be more socially divisive, and there's sort of a ostracization process that can go on among girls, as we've seen things like Mean Girls, where if you aren't in the know or you don't care about yourself physically at this level, there's a certain social pariah aspect to it.
Back to the phones now to Charleston, South Carolina. Dave is on the line. Hi, Dave. Welcome.
Hi, Jane. Thanks for taking my call.
Thank you for calling.
I guess I've got a couple of comments first. Being in Charleston, just so you know, I'm not a real conservative. I'm pretty socially liberal. But one of the things, my daughter goes to an all-girls school. She's 8 years old, and one of the things that the school instituted was a uniform, as well as always wearing sneakers. And the biggest pushback that we received was actually from the parents, not from the children. And I just think that that kind of goes to the fact that I don't think children are naturally drawn to these sorts of things. It's all the adult world being imposed on these kids. And it's so critically important for parents and educators to dismiss that message as irrelevant, because it really is, especially at this age. And that's something, as a father, you know, I was always told that a daughter's self-image is very much derived from the interaction that she has with her father. I don't know how true that is, but one of the things that I've worked very, very hard at is really not only trying to, you know, limit the amount of marketing she has, but to combat that marketing and tell her, you know, these things are irrelevant, these things are junk. And now she'll even see, you know, an ad or something, and she'll even say, oh, that's junk, without even, as I'm walking by the room or something to that effect. So, you know, I think it really does fall squarely on the shoulders of adults, parents, and educators to combat this marketing, because it is ridiculous. Children should be children. They're not young adults. They're not women. And they shouldn't be concerned about those sorts of issues.
Dave, thanks so much for your call. Jeannie Brooks Gunn, is there anything positive to marketing to these young girls? We're hearing a lot of negatives here. Is there anything positive to it?
Well, you can use marketing for social good, and there are really great examples, although not usually for this age, of using marketing to promote more healthy eating. In general, the commercial marketing does not do this, but social marketing does. And in fact, if anything, you're seeing companies, because of pushback from parents and advocacy groups, limit their marketing of sugary foods. 11 of the food companies have gotten together, and they're going to limit some of their marketing. That doesn't answer your question. When I look at commercial marketing, if the purpose is to sell products and to grow a consumer, right? Mm-hmm. Growing a child, mm-hmm. It might be growing a consumer. I don't see much value in that, although I think marketing techniques can be used for positive purposes.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about the preteen market and how it affects growing girls. Camille Sweeney is with us. She writes for The New York Times. Her article, Never Too Young for That First Pedicure, appeared recently. Jeannie Brooks Gunn is also with us. She is a professor of child development at Columbia University and co-director of the National Center for Children and Families. And right now I'd like to bring in Joan Jacobs-Brumberg. She is in Ithaca, New York. She is professor emerita at Cornell University, where she has taught history, human development, and gender studies for nearly 30 years. She is author of The Body Project, An Intimate History of American Girls, and Fasting Girls, The Emergence of Anorexia Nervosa as a Modern Disease. Joan, thanks for being with us. Appreciate it.
Hi, Jane. Nice to be here.
So you've been listening to our conversation, marketing to these young girls as young as 6 years old. What do you make of it from an historical perspective?
Okay, absolutely. I mean, I'm speaking as a historian. Starter markets and primping parties are fascinating. historical phenomenon. I will admit at the start, I'm suspicious, and I don't like it. But I want to tell you a little bit about it historically first.
Okay, go ahead.
First of all, from the kind of research that I've done over the past 30 years, reading about the lives of girls and girls' descriptions of their lives going back into the 19th century, it's clear that very young girls have been imitating older women, you know, kind of dressing up, if you will, for a very long time, mm-hmm. whether it's putting on their mother's shoes or their hair ribbons or what have you. So there's a kind of mimetic or imitative tradition or behavior that we see in young girls. Today it's Hannah Montana. In the 19th century, there was a period of time when a lot of girls were getting what were called Kemble cuts, because there was an actress named Fanny Kemble, and they were all cutting their hair, you know, like the stage actress that they admired. So that phenomenon, or the capacity for girls to be interested in imitative stuff and social kind of aping of mothers and older women and girls, that's just, I think, kind of hardwired into the organism, if you will.
And yet, Professor, when historically did we take a turn for something a little different? What Camille is talking about, the social beauty of all this.
Right. It begins to change in the really in the 20th century. Early 20th century, in the 20s, when you begin to get more direct marketing to youth. Now, youth at that point meant teenagers and young adults who had some money, who were participating, who had wages, and the middle-class kids who had allowances for the first time.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this phenomenon that we're dealing with now, this starter market concept, of marketing to girls 5, 6, 7, and 8, who are, let me just point out, just going to school for the first time and just learning how to read, seems to me to be something extremely different, and I believe that it is absolutely embedded in a larger cultural obsession with perfection of the body.
I was so interested in your book, Professor, when you looked at the diaries of women from ages 13 and older from the 19th century to the 1990s.
Right.
And the emphasis that has changed in these young lives is quite significant. The emphasis from
a desire for good works to a desire for good looks.
Right, right.
And you can see it in the words of girls, in the kinds of stories that they tell about themselves, about, you can hear it in their voices, this increasing anxiety, discontent, agita, I don't know what you want to call it, about do I look good enough, and how am I going to construct my identity. And increasingly, of course, the construction of identity is embedded in consumer activity, in making purchases, of having one's hair cut, not at home, but outside, you know, a stranger paying somebody to cut your hair. It has to do with makeup, as adult women begin to do more of that. It has to do with movies. It has to do with the availability of mirrors. There are so many technological, economic, social pieces to the story of why body projects have become a national obsession. But what's interesting here for our discussion today is that it's not just adults these days. We are letting this stuff, this obsession, kind of filter down into our little kids. The child is consumer. I don't think that these organized commercial activities, I don't think they respect childhood, and I believe that they actually, that things like primping parties actually are stealing the imagination.
I want to get a call, an interesting call here in, Professor, from Rockport, Massachusetts. Eileen is on the line. Eileen, welcome to you.
Thank you, Jane. I'll tell you, this whole thing is so crazy to me, and in a sense, I think it's obscene. But I've enjoyed listening to your experts, especially the ones that, like me, feel shame on the marketers, shame on the parents who go along with this stuff. They're turning these kids into little glamour robots. I am 74 years old, just got back from a great ski trip in Maine, my third one of the year. I have never had a pedicure, a manicure, don't even own a cell phone. I have thoroughly enjoyed my life, and I was never sophisticated as a child or as an adult. And I think this is horrible. What have we done to childhood? I grew up 6 to 8. I didn't even know there was an opposite sex. I had playmates. And when I go skiing on elder hostel programs, I still have playmates, men and women I enjoy skiing with. What have we done to childhood? I think it's a shame. I'm glad I grew up before television.
Eileen, thanks so much for your call. Jeannie Brooks-Gunn, has this happened over the last generation or two? You hear Eileen, 74, never had a pedicure. She remembers very different days.
Well, she's right. She's absolutely right. Things have really changed. Marketing has pervaded childhood. That's the way we need to think about it. And that's what we talk a lot about in The Future of Children, our special issue that we've just finished, as well as trying to understand, and this is what David said earlier, which I really liked, what parents can do to counteract it. I want to make the point that it's pretty hard for a single parent to counteract all of the marketing influences, but parents can help and educate their children on what marketing means. They also can limit the amount of marketing that comes into their houses. They can't get rid of it altogether. And they can also be very aware of the new marketing techniques that are being used online, since their children are online. So clearly, Joan is right, of course, in that girls have always imitated their mothers, just like boys have always imitated their fathers. That is different than having primping parties for five-year-olds.
Well, so Camille, I guess based on what Jeannie just said, from your reporting for your story for the New York Times, what were parents saying about how they were to combat this, about what marketing means and how they teach that to their children? Were they throwing their arms up in the air and saying, well, there's just so much influence, what can I do? Or what were the thoughts?
It's interesting, and I think Jeannie's right in the sense that this is sort of the area to concentrate on. For the most part, I would say that the parents were feeling at sea with the issue. They know that there's something more they should be doing, but they don't know what it is.
And may I make a point about this?
Sure.
Yes, please, Professor.
You know, I think there's a lot of confusion here. I get ever since I wrote the book, The Body Project, which addresses a lot of these issues, particularly the early eroticization of girls, I've been asked questions by parents, mothers in particular, about what can I do? In other words, how, you know, what happens when my parenting and commerce meet in my living room and my little girl
right.
wants to do something that I don't feel easy about? So I want to suggest that there's an enormous amount of unease today about appropriateness.
And so what do you say to the answer to the question?
Not, and people need to understand it's not about morality. These are not moral questions. These are questions about appropriateness and whether parents are willing to move from passive parenting and allowing the notion that it's okay for their girls to be driven by the market. I don't believe, by the way, that these little girls are driven so much by the market. I think their school groups, their neighborhoods, their families, there are many different contexts which are influencing their development. And I think parents these days need a lot of support for saying no, for saying, I don't think that you should dress this particular way to go to school, that particular, let's say, midriff-divulging, cleavage-displaying shirt that you're wearing at age 9 is fine for the backyard, but today's a school day. And most women, I believe, and men, intelligent men, do understand that it's in their daughter's best interests to be a bit more on the, if you will, and I'm not an old-fashioned, conventional Victorian about this, but a little bit more on the protective side, given the fact that we really don't live yet in a culture where we can guarantee the safety of little girls.
Professor, thank you. Let's move back to the phones for a moment. Anne is calling from Chapel Hill, North Carolina. Hi, Anne. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Jane. Thanks for taking my call.
Certainly.
I just wanted to comment on what your panel was saying about this focus on beauty at a younger age might lead to eating disorders at a younger age. And I went through that process in high school. All of my friends were totally focused on their outward appearance. No one could see them without makeup on except for their very, very, very closest friends. And I totally bucked against that and thought it was ridiculous. But at the same time, I did feel kind of like a pariah for not buying into it. And I think the way that I coped with that was by developing an eating disorder. And now I'm 21 and I'm in college and still dealing with it. And I can totally see that happening to girls at a much younger age if they feel the same pressures.
So given what you've been through, Anne, then what would you say to parents and to these little kids about what about what's going on?
I just think it's so important to, you know, like if you have a big event, you know, that you're going to, then yes, get dressed up and curl your hair and, you know, maybe put a little bit of blush on, maybe like some tinted lip gloss or something. But until you get a whole lot older, it's so unnecessary to make your appearance such a big deal. And I think that it's important for parents to emphasize that too, because my mom is not a superficial person, but she would even say things like, when I was in high school, Meg, before you go out, or Anne, before you go out, maybe you should put a little makeup on. And it drove me crazy because I thought that should not be necessary for me to be accepted by people.
Anne, I so appreciate your call. We're running out of time. I really thank you for your perspectives. Let's get another call in from Melissa, who is in Acton, Massachusetts. Melissa, welcome to you. Hi.
Hi, Jane.
Hi.
I'm a parent of three kids. One is a boy, and I have two girls, aged 9 and 7. And I can so happily say, having listened for this hour, which has been fantastic, my kids still completely want to play with their tadpoles versus put on any nail polish or do anything else related to beauty products.
Mm-hmm.
And I see this as a parenting problem versus a marketing problem. We have a capitalist society. We are always going to have marketing going towards a dollar. And we as families have to create the voice that our children hear, not marketers. And in line with that, my family, maybe unconventionally, made the decision very early on that my kids did not watch a single bit of commercial TV until they were 5. Hmm. Because that I felt like all that was doing was trying to sell and mold my child. And it's been good for us. There's a lot of other good TV on or videos. They didn't need it.
You've regulated it. I so appreciate your call, Melissa. I'm running out of time. Wish we could hear more from you. So I'm hearing a similar theme from our callers. You know, it's not about the marketing necessarily, although it's strong. It's about the parent and parental impact and involvement. Does the panel agree? Jeannie Brooks Gunn, you first.
Parents can do a lot, but as I said earlier, some of the marketing is so pervasive that it's very difficult. And I think it's great when we can give parents tips and how to counteract some of these messages, because I think that parents do have more control than they think they do. One other thing I just want to quick say, I know we're almost out of time, but it's the eating disorder issue. As we are talking about social beauty, we have an epidemic of obesity in children. And I just want everybody listening to think about what that means as we're also promoting a particular type of body and look for very young girls. The obesity rate is almost a third among children.
Camille Sweeney, a contributor to the New York Times, we started with you and your piece, Never Too Young for That First Pedicure. About 30 seconds to end with you now.
Well, I would just want to add that there is this sort of more pervasive, indulgent parenting style, which we as parents don't have to be that way. You don't have to be authoritarian, but you can be authoritative. Do things like encourage different kinds of TV watching or movie watching and de-emphasize this issue of having to be ready for your close-up.
Camille Sweeney, contributor to the New York Times, thanks so much for your piece and for your time today. Jeannie Brooks-Gunn, professor emerita at Cornell. Actually, that's Joan Jacobs-Brumberg. Thanks so much to you, professor. Appreciate it.
Thanks.
All right. And Jeannie Brooks-Gunn, professor of child development at Columbia. Thanks so much to you, Jeannie.
Thanks, Jane.
You can continue the conversation and download the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. I'm Jane Clayson. This is On Point.